to become my synapse, where to be comes first.
Hey, what's up, everybody? Welcome to another episode of Become. Here we explore topics we are passionate about, personal growth and entrepreneurship. So get yourself comfortable, turn the volume up, and be ready to be mind blown.
So welcome to the Synapse Podcast. My name is Alex Gabon, and today I have the honor to receive someone that has a curriculum that is really impressive, that founded 5 fintech in 3 countries, accompanied 30 major innovations in more than 15 corporations. And I mean, it's just very long to read all his accomplishments, and he's a great human being, someone with which has deep values. And before I met him, I already heard about him from many people. So it's a great pleasure to have you today. Thank you, Nathan, for being here.
Thank you for having me here, Alex. When someone like you asks anything, it's an honor to say yes. Thank you.
Very kind of you. Do you want to start by telling us your background, where you come from? You know, when someone is a great entrepreneur like you, we want to know the parents were entrepreneur, which environment you grew up, these kind of things.
Well, I was born in Brazil in 1960. And at that time, Brazil was searching for its future, and perhaps it's still on the search of the future. And my parents were from Iran. They were Baha'i pioneers in Brazil. So I came from a family that took risks for an ideology or for something in their heart that told them it's worth it. And moving to Brazil, it was something I can imagine very difficult at that time, without knowing the language and anything, without having the support. So I think I might say that I came from people that were risk takers in a way, but my father particularly was really into planning ahead, creating scenarios. And I watched him since I was 12 or 13, strategizing on power plant and generator projects in Brazil. At that time, there was a lot of infrastructure. And he was working with a Swiss company. And I remember that I would try to pay attention, and I was a very curious guy, and I loved Lego and creating something. And I started learning with the combination of these two things, how to project something that is long-term and have a vision. I think I learned with him, with his environment of planning. And although he was a planner and a strategizer, I once heard master strategizer from a very influential person in Brazil that your dad was a master strategizer. So I think I got a little bit, not much of his talent, but I got the side of the vision of creating something from scratch. And that was my background in the 60s in Brazil. And until I started working with fintech, and that's another thing, more recent, from 20 years ago.
I find so beautiful the wording you put, right? Risk-taking for an ideal. And this is such a powerful way to define one aspect of entrepreneurship that is quite important, actually quite fundamental. And I love when you talk about creating from Lego, because my son is 6 years old. He wants to play Lego every day. That's his thing. So probably creativity is strong in him, and I mean entrepreneurship.
You know, you can be an excellent Lego player, but you can also use Lego and do something which we call out of the box. I'm sure entrepreneurs understand that. When you do not do what the framework of the box is telling you to do, and you think, what else can I do using these parts? It's very similar, like having resources, human resources, people resources, I mean, IP, intellectual property, business, investment, and getting them together. And the big question then is, since I'm not following the manual, but I have all these pieces, what can I create with that? And that, I think, it's a wonderful tool. And I really encourage my kids to have Lego as well, because I think it projects their capacity to imagine something built without having a manual.
And how did you start it? Did you get, you know, some safe jobs? Were you going for risk-taking straight away? How was the beginning of your job?
No, I started in a way that I would not recommend. Maybe when I was a young boy and my dream was having a nice job in a multinational Swiss company, just like my dad. But when I got to university, I was really lucky to get to a good university at that time, and still is the best university in the Southern Hemisphere. So that's not much to say in terms of ranking, because it's over 100. Nothing compared to Ivy League and European educational institutions, but USP was hard to get at that time. Mm-hmm. And I got it because I loved to design, and there was a selection process that mm-hmm. thousands applied for those 150 chairs. And I got the privilege, I would say, the luck of being accepted. But right when I was there, ready to come out from architecture course, and I was a designer, always working with design and, you know, the Lego thing and the design and the ability to draw. So I really wanted to become a designer. And I started working with a French company from the Renault, La Régie Renault. And it was opening a prototype institution or prototype startup in Brazil. And I got a job and I started working with Formula One with the former champion Nelson Piquet. So I was into design, although I was studying architecture. But I got my first rejection when I was there. And this is what I want to tell you. Although I was lucky and I had the means and I got this wonderful thing, I applied to study at the Royal College of Art in London. And it was my first rejection. And now, many, many years later, I know that one of the things that I should have been humble and accepted was that rejection. And I should have tried again and tried to get the scholarship. And my life would be absolutely different if I had that master's degree in design. But because I got a no, and I think I was too arrogant when I was young, I decided, oh, these guys tell me no, I'll tell them I don't need to study in England. I'll open my own company and become a successful designer. And that's what I did. And this is the mistake. I think you can't make decisions out of arrogance, out of lack of humility. And I did that. It's not that it wasn't successful. I worked with, I created a design studio. I was the principal designer, the director, maybe became at some time the third largest in Brazil. And, but it started with spite, really. And I wasn't prepared. I think what I have to say, even to young entrepreneurs, is instead of having a first job in which you are the president because you are the entrepreneur, be humble and go and learn somewhere. Have a good job. Even if your path is to become an entrepreneur, I think having a job teaches you a lot of human and soft skills that when you just simply become the president of a company when you're 23, like I was, you end up not learning those things in time. I don't know if I answered your question.
Beautiful advice. I mean, the intention of decisions, right? And those spiritual principles behind how you make them. And arrogance in my life has been my biggest bottleneck for entrepreneurship. And the reason why I crashed and failed and learned many times was ego, for sure was what was missing for me to have the right people and the right resources and the right ecosystem. And I'm still fighting with it every day. And clearly, arrogance, especially when we are young, is a challenge.
It's not a short one battle fight. It's a fight you will have until the last days of your life. And I think I not always win. But I tell you, it's a fight you should win before you become an entrepreneur. Because when you become an entrepreneur, although you have to learn to be sometimes independent and make your own decisions, there is a lot of risk involved, but also there's a lot of listening involved, and that you learn when you become more humble, not when you are arrogant, as I was.
And what happened next then? So you took some risk, you become this entrepreneur.
So I had a job actually, but it was a short-term thing because one of my clients insisted I had to be in their, payroll. Mm. So he didn't accept me to be, let's say at that time you called it a freelancer, a designer. They wanted to have a designer in the team. So I said, well, as long as I can have all the clients, so modestly, sort of what happened to Apple's designer, but they let me have my own company while I was working there. So that was a job. Mm-hmm. And I quit it, I mean, after 1 year and a half, and I only had my clients, and I started designing computer cabinets, and you know, the external form and function of a computer, not the design circuit, not the hardware or the software. And I started working with printers and monitors and computers at that time. A lot of these designs are got some prizes. And if you look at them and you think they were designed in 83, in 86, in 88, so many years ago that I can't even believe it's 30 years ago. But you look at the design of computers at that time, you see that there was something new in that form and function. But anyway, this is what started augmenting, and there was more and more clients, and it was, I guess I could say, it was a successful practice. But then again, a group of people that were related to my clients, and they wanted to start a new startup. So they said, listen, Nathan, we need a marketing guy and a designer. And we have the hardware and software engineers already, and you're too expensive to be an employee. So can you come an owner here with us? So this is when I had my second company, is when I was invited to have a computer company called Procisa Informatica. That was in 1987, if I'm not wrong. And then in 87, we created the first computer company in Brazil that was already launching a product that was injected in ABS plastic and was very innovative, had a small footprint like this because we wanted it to fit into an open magazine. And at that time, to have that much memory in a small computer that would actually fit the magazine open, the, you know, two-page ad, was a feat in itself. And then, so we did that. We started Procisa Informatica, and gradually it became my main activity. And I finally, 10 years later, in 1996, I closed the design shop. And that has a funny thing, is that it was intentional, because my wife, I got married right between these two things, and my wife wanted to have five kids. Mm. Five children. And then I realized that as a designer in Brazil, I couldn't do that. I couldn't support a family with five children with the design activity, because the way design grows in Europe and in the US and et cetera is with licensing your design property rights, right? The licenses, the IP, and getting some kind of royalty. And my biggest success was a product with 27 million copies, but I never got a dime of royalty. So I thought, because of the institutional and cultural way that designers saw in Brazil, or was at that time, but I would say pretty much today too, and the lack of moral fabric of you know, having so much cheating and particularly on law, on royalty rights, it's very hard to reinforce them. So I thought, I can't make my living out of on design. And I decided dedicating myself to IT, to information technology, which was growing incredibly in the early 90s. And in the mid 90s with the internet, I got into the internet wave, let's say. In a nutshell, that's how I went, I crossed from the old century to this century in IT.
I love the fact that you said you were too expensive to be an employee, so you had a chance to be.
Well, that's what they do.
And your skill, and also the fact that because of your aspirations with your wife and children, change your career as well, right? We see in Synapse, we talk a lot about the integration of the 12 pillars of life and how it comes together. So That's beautiful. Yeah. And today, Nathan, what's your mission today? What are your responsibilities today? Let's jump to the present now.
Yeah, okay. So after many years working with IT and having clients as banks as clients, really, I decided that first I should have a pause because I should understand the Canadian environment. So, and I should grow a local network. I always say that you can't be an entrepreneur if you don't measure the network in a way. And it's not the way people measure how many friends they have at Facebook. It's to see if the reach of your reputation as a decent entrepreneur, as an honest man, touches base in different realms of knowledge, like how many lawyers you have that trust you, how many entrepreneurs that could invest in your company you know in that country, how many IT people you have, how many project managers you know that if you call them and say, come and work with me, they will. And I didn't have those things in Canada. So 8 years ago, I measured by LinkedIn that if I had like, at that time, I had like around 900 connections. And I thought, well, from these 900, only 30 are from Canada. So I decided I can't be an entrepreneur in Canada until I understand the Canadian culture and I expand my network, really. So I started intensifying my contacts and I had over 150 coffee meetings with people that never saw me, which means 300 didn't want to have the coffee with me. I called 400 people and I can say now I have 3,300 contacts at LinkedIn. Most of them are in Canada. So when I felt I am ready, I started something different. Instead of working to build something to sell to companies, B2B, I decided creating a platform business in which, as you know, a platform is when you unite different groups of people. It could be a social platform like Facebook or a different platform. I decided creating a platform in sports. And the reason is a long story that maybe doesn't fit here, but it's not only on sports. It's using my knowledge in payments and in blockchain. So I united cryptocurrencies and sports in a way that I could create social impact in poor countries and at the same time have a sustainable, profitable business. That's what I thought I could build. And the name is Link Sports. Very conveniently, Link Sports looks like LinkedIn. It is not simply the LinkedIn of sports, but it is similar in some ways. So now I'm doing Link Sports.
Wow. And how does Link Sports make a social impact in poor countries? I was curious.
Well, I am sure that it does because, you know, if you look at many industries like banking or retail or air and space, all of them at some point are growing, becoming mature, and they consolidate the big companies into the hands of three or four or five large multinationals. But if you look at sports, they were always not consolidated, but very concentrated in the hands of the five, six larger teams. It was always like this for over a century. So you see soccer, you see baseball, you see basketball or hockey or cricket in India. It's always like this. It's three or four teams control billions of dollars. And of course, 10 or 20 players make combined more than 10,000 players in that country. Those guys combined make maybe $200 million a year. And the rest of the 30,000 professional players don't even make $5 million a year together. So I thought, perfect space for disintermediation because there is a lot of tension and inequality. And this is on the salary side and on the business side. Look at the other side, which is the dream of boys and girls to become a professional. What is the chance they have if they live in a small village 100 kilometers from Bangalore in India to become a cricket star? Or if they are in a favela in a smaller town in Brazil. We're 150 kilometers away from the capital of Mato Grosso do Sul. They have no chance because there is no team, there is no scout, and nobody's gonna ever find them. So I thought, this is the way to disrupt. If I give visibility to these people, so their talent matters, not where they live, not how much money they have, and especially not who they know in a large team that will give them a chance. That's how I think it will disrupt and have a social impact. Because as you know, Alex, I'm from Brazil. So if you talk about the reality of a Brazilian family, sometimes their whole hope to stop paying rent and having their little small private home, and their only hope is for one of the kids to become a football player. And how can you help these people doing that? And how can you actually concentrate on skills and talent, not so much on the relationship network of that little boy?
This is
so beautiful. That's where the impact comes.
This is very inspiring that you could build such a business. It's a very recent one. You started about 2 years ago, right? Like it's a late one.
Yes, I've been working on it for 3 years, but started being designed in terms of strategy 2 years ago, and the company was incorporated over 1 year ago.
Wow. And now you have, I see, 13 people already. So there is a
team. Yeah, we have 34 people helping us. And I think that proves the social impact, you know. Mm. If you ask me, well, you have 34 people, can't be a startup, an early stage startup. But it is. It is only because there is a vision that attracts people. And that is maybe the main contribution I could have, is I'm so proud of these people because they have a lot of other things to be doing. They are not people that are not busy. They are very senior, prestigious people that are very good in their area, either marketing or sports industry or gamification, technology. There are lawyers, there are you name it. And all these people are giving their contribution. And this is the point, 70% of them are helping us pro bono. They're working in exchange, of course, some of them with options, but a lot of them are helping because they believe in the vision. They want to do the social impact. They want to be involved with something bigger than ourselves. So I think that is a privilege, to have a vision in which you actually, as a magnet, attract talent. I can say not every idea I had would have been lucky enough to have these 32 people. But of course, from them, we have a staff included in this 32 people, people that are, of course, paid salaries and et cetera. Mm-hmm. But because we have 14 committees working together to design this global company, because this is a global vision, of course, when you succeed in soccer, it's not necessarily true that we'll succeed in cricket or in hockey. But the structure, the software, the code, the database, and a lot of things are replicable. So we believe that because the problems of sports all over the world are the same, or the high concentration in the hand of five or six men that take all the decision and get 80% of the money, and millions of people dream on becoming a professional player, we believe that this can grow all over the world.
We could say, Nathan, that you're a serial entrepreneur. Before that, you had four other fintech companies that you started in different places. So this is the latest one, but you've started and sold companies in the past. How was
Recently in Canada, I was involved with two startups. So this would be the third. On those, I wasn't shareholder or controller. I was hired as a consultant. So I learned a lot there. And in fact, in one of them, they asked me to be the CEO. And I learned a lot from these experiences in Canada. But before that, I had also two fintechs in Brazil. And then one of them is called eSafe Transfer. eSafe Transfer started creating a solution for Visa International, for them to be able to download cash into a smart card. Mm-hmm. You know, your country calls it carte à puce. Mm-hmm. So the cards with chip, which are prevalent now, were not 20 years ago. Mm-hmm. So they wanted something to be able to download cash to the chip. And we created a solution at ICE France, and then we pivoted the company and created a payment system for schools. Mm-hmm. Actually, we created two. One for schools called School Cash, mm-hmm. for parents to be safe that the money they give to their kids will not be spent with drugs and tobacco, but only in the school cafeteria. So it was a dedicated payments system in Brazil. Many schools were using it. And the other system, we created a cryptocurrency called Hut Cash, and we sold it to Pizza Hut. Sold it, meaning they were using it for 9 years, and it was the way that you would buy pizza and whatever at Pizza Hut in São Paulo, my city, the city I was born, was actually using a conversion rate that was in favor to the Brazilian currency. So you would trade your 100 reais for 120 Hut Cash. And the menu was the same price for reais and Hut Cash. So people had a perception that you are granting them 20% more of buying power if they buy the currency of Pizza Hut. And that's what they did. Over 100,000 people were doing it. And it was very, very, operationally speaking, very interesting for Pizza Hut. So so that is my step forward into cryptocurrency. And that's why when I came to Canada, before I started becoming an entrepreneur, I was teaching blockchain and cryptocurrencies at the university here. And this is also something that expanded my network.
I love this concept of the network that you brought and the reach of the reputation and bringing people together for entrepreneurship. And we can see in your journey that you love to solve social problems, and each business was answering to different needs. Could you tell us about personal development as well? So in Synapse, we believe that entrepreneurship is a great way to grow, to develop yourself, but also that in order to be an entrepreneur, you have to have a certain level of personal development. It's not just technical skills. You need emotional intelligence a bit. Can you tell us a bit about your journey of transforming yourself as a human being in order to be able to be the leader you are today?
Yes, I would love to do that. And I'll start saying, what is your personal difficulty? You have to look at yourself very honestly and see what is your personal shortcoming. And then you have to look at the business and see what kind of soft skills you have to run that. And particularly running is in another stage. It's when the company is having an income and et cetera. But to create a vision out of nothing and to involve people, there are another set of skills. I felt comfortable with some of them. But let me talk to you about the difficulties I had, and I still have. I think my major difficulty is listening creatively. I'm so clogged and processing so many things at the same time that for me to give people 100% of attention, it is a personal shortcoming that I have to develop. Just like when you may have good muscles in your upper body, but you feel weak in your feet, so I have to develop daily. Now, on the other hand, I think that as maybe you would use the word facilitator of diversity, I will use the word integrator. As an integrator of diversity, I think I am comfortable creating a space in which people can manifest their ideas freely. And this is the core thing at Linksports. You cannot be a global company, even from the start. And I call our vision a global vision. So I call our company our global company. We have already 7 nationalities in it. People in our company speak 5 languages. So what I think is that you have to create an appreciation, more than an appreciation, a love for diversity. Otherwise, how can you deal with, you know, hockey that is so different from cricket or baseball? So we love diversity. And in order to grow, we have to understand that our biggest capacity is to be together, although we are different from each other. So the talents I brought into this group of people, and which I am so honored to have backing me up. And I tell you with all sincerity, when I'm in a meeting with my senior advisors, I'm sure I'm the dumbest guy in the room, because I chose these people and I'm honored they accepted coming. But the talent, you might say, that as a leader I try to have is to integrate the diverse visions that they have and to let them contribute so that the vision becomes collective, not Nason's vision. And now I can say with all sincerity and frankness, and that this is a vision that transcends my vision from 3 years ago. It is a vision that encompasses all the talents of these people. I'm a marketing guy per se, maybe not technically, but there are technical people in marketing that can help me. I understand a little bit digital media, but certainly not even 100 of what's necessary. So I have a PhD in digital marketing helping us as a co-founder. I have been around developers since the early 80s. I understand how they think, but who am I to understand the new technologies? I mean, the things I was used to, C++ and other languages of development, are long gone. Almost nobody knows them. Now there are new languages that appear every day. So I have to have young people that are talented in technology, like Zohra Sheikh, my co-founder, and presently working at Linksports as director of platform delivery. So, and I have to understand how to attract people, because this is the core of the business, is to have and downloaded an app in your cell phone and come back every day and give the platform your data about your athletic performance. So how do you do this? You have to understand gamification. You have to understand how to structure a score of that boy or girl's talent, but not in a you know, lame, non-interesting and very boring way. You have to do it with gamification. So I have Nagano, who is also in the executive team, and he's a specialist that work with Jogos Grow in Brazil, a big company that does gaming, board games. For 30 years he worked there. So he understands how to make people come back. He understands licenses. He licensed, I don't know, all these important companies in the world, from Disney to other companies. How can a person do these things alone? You can't. So the first thing you have to see is that there's no space to be egotistical. You have to open the space for other talents. And talent just come on board when they see that they're appreciated and heard, and that their opinion will transform the vision. And the vision will evolve with their experience. And when they look at the company, they see themselves reflected there. So this conversation started with my shortcomings, certainly. I'm aware of it. But one thing I can say I'm learning is how to work with different people. Mm-hmm. And that, you might say, I do with a reasonable amount of success. And that's, I think, the characteristic of an early stage startup CEO that wants to be global. Now, of course, there are many other characteristics I might not have. And in time, we'll solve that, not necessarily by changing an old man like me, but by having another CEO. But I am proud to say I learned early that not everything you need to have, you will be able to develop. There is some time you have to know the difference of hiring or having a partner or just, you know, just changing the structure of your business, because you cannot have all the talent necessary to survive when the company evolves. You have to go after new people. So that is, in a nutshell, I think I gave you a very long answer, but this is what I feel about human talents and skills.
Thank you, Nathan, for that very enlightening. A question that we hear a lot in our community, in our audience of people becoming entrepreneurs, is the financial aspect, right? So they are afraid to switch from a corporate job to an entrepreneurship job to change your lifestyle and how to raise funds. I don't know if in your company you have done a round of like raising money with startup people, or how will you talk about this raising capital for the company and also your personal finances as you go in entrepreneurship, the management of this risk and
Yeah, there are many books that talk about that phase. In fact, some scholars, they measure the phase you are in the search of capital by some facts, like, for instance, have the founders quit their job? Mm. You know, are you taking the risk? Mm. Do you have to make a living out of this? Or it's your side thing that you do in the weekends? Are the principal key people that you're bringing in working as in exchange for shares, or they're already having a salary? So these things show the amount of risk you're taking. And investors want to see clearly how much risk you're taking, but, you know, measuring risk. For instance, sometimes an entrepreneur has some means to survive 1 year without getting a salary. Then he'll put this as stake in the company. Say, listen, Alex, you come and become my partner. I know you'll have to have this salary, but don't worry, my part will be doing this and this, and I can maybe not have a salary for some time. So these things are when you approach the business in the very early stage, in which you are offering your time, which is the most valuable and limited thing you have, but for free. Now, when you call an angel or an early stage angel, or you organize a family and friends, you're actually selling yourself, not the company, because family and friends invest because they love you, or they like you, or they know your talents from the times of school, I don't know what. They're not necessarily thinking that this company will work out or not. That's why usually family and friends are a $2,000 contribution, $5,000 for you to pay for, I don't know, a place you can start having your team working, and some of them need a $500 salary a month, and then you take from that money. And some people just, you know, you just, they help you being afloat with your credit card bill that is great, getting bigger and bigger, and your debts. This is the typical startup company that's starts in the garage. But when you want to have a global vision that will need hundreds of millions of dollars to be accomplished or built, even the first phase is different. And especially because you have senior people that have gone through these experiences. But if my audience is of young people, I think you have to find a combined group of people that are complementing their lack of talent in not one specific thing. So I have shortcomings in marketing. Necessarily, I have to have a co-founder that is more comfortable. I have a weak point on finance. I have to have another guy maybe that will be my partner. And certainly in today's world, every business needs technology. So one of the problems is not having a partner that is a technology person. If you combine these people, then you have a second problem. Who said that they can all work without a salary? So there is a point in which they're still looking at the business as a side thing, and they are working in their own companies. But I guess when you start having people investing, they want you to invest your time 100%. So maybe it's the time to say, okay, I'm quitting my company, but at least I need an investor that pays this amount of salary. And that investor says, okay, if you quit your company and get half of the salary, I know you're sacrificing for the business, then I'll pay you. Because if you're not quitting your company, who said you believe in the business? If you don't believe in the business, why should I put $15,000? So these things are a little synchronistical, and maybe they depend on luck, on people you know, but you have to strategize. You have to know the right time to quit your job. You have to know the right message you give by saying, I'm putting my own money. And these things require some kind of emotional intelligence. You have to feel empathy. You have to know if a cousin of yours would ask $10,000 for their business and he was just sitting and having his job comfortably, would you do it? Or would you be more inclined to do it when you see that he's risking his own income as well? So these are the questions I think we have to ask ourselves.
Beautiful answers. And what about reading? I guess you read a lot. And I mean, one of the things we get asked a lot is about morning routine. You know, what do you do in the morning to be at your best, and what books you read? What kind of secrets you have in order to be the best version of yourself in the face of big risks that sometimes can affect your family? And that's a common challenge that all entrepreneurs will face, right? As you said, there is rejection, there is risk, there is many things. What's your take on this?
Well, I have a poor memory, so I will probably have to refer to some of these books without remembering very well who the author is. But I can tell you, I read a lot about blockchain because it's a new thing and nobody can say that understands of it. And even me, I teach blockchain, but I have to read constantly every day about blockchain. I read a lot about company valuation because I think my job as a CEO is to create value to my partners, to my employees, and to the investors. Creating value, it's a very complex thing. And it requires every step you give, you have to think about the next three steps. But there are many books that talk about that, as how do you do the dilution of capital in a way that with the progress of the company, your stake in it is getting smaller and smaller. And I've been reading for some time a book on startups and valuation. I can go and pick them up if you want. But one of them that I keep telling people that if they don't read it, I should have read or written a book like this. It's my wife a few days ago, she came to me and said, oh, our friend in Luxembourg told you to buy this book. Why startups do not succeed. And it was so funny that this week she bought it on Amazon and I started reading it yesterday. But I said to my wife, listen, this book, I should write this book. Why do startups do not succeed? But I'm reading that. And I'm reading books about valuation. I'm reading a book about network business, because network business is absolutely different from B2B and B2C. It's creating a community, really. And then you face the problem of egg and chicken, because you don't have a community, you don't have data. You don't have data, you don't have what to offer the users. The users don't see any advantage of coming into the platform and they don't come. It's almost like LinkedIn in 2004. Or it's almost like getting into a good restaurant, but you were the first client. Have you felt that when you come in with your wife and suddenly you look around and all the tables are empty and you feel bad? So how do you actually go around this egg and chicken problem? And these things are things you can read and learn. So this is what I'm doing. And particularly when people ask me what book should I read, I sense that before they read the books I'm reading now, they have a problem with even looking at innovation in a different way. There is a book that is the Bible of innovators, right? Is written by Clayton Christensen from MIT. I do have it here. Let me remember the name. Yeah. So the innovator's dilemma. I think if you want to be an entrepreneur, you have to understand innovation. So the first thing that helps you is to actually read something about innovation and understand why companies succeed in innovation. These are particularly companies that are smaller and came out of the group of companies that were controlling that business. Why did Kodak went bankrupt? Everybody has an answer for that, but it's a very shallow answer. You have to read exactly why. So what is the meaning of looking out of the box? All these things, if you do not understand, why will you create a startup? You have to understand these things.
And what about coaching, mentoring, masterminds? Have you used these resources for yourself in this?
I read Presence. I love Theory U. I love the papers related to the Adizes Institute that teach people to work with diversity. And I'm aware that there is a methodology or a process to integrate visions. It's a lot of study and academics behind it. Mm-hmm. And particularly this society that I love, because I didn't tell you, but one of the companies I do have here in Canada is a company that does innovation consultancy, and it's called InnovaAdvice. And in that company, we have a product called Attract. Attract stands for a system that we call experiential learning journey. So you get people together in a company or so, and you help them achieving a level of consensus, you know, and this has a totally connected to blockchain, because blockchain is based on DLT. This DLT stands for distributed ledger technology. And when you have many blocks in the hands of everyone publicly, like Bitcoin, and you have to have consensus to see which blocks are not corrupted. It's funny that it reflects what happens with human beings. Unless you have trust and an ambiance of diversity, you do not have consensus. If you don't have consensus, you're deciding based on power, on shares, on being the CEO. And that is not a very interesting way to make decisions. So I'm trying to make a bridge. So I love what you just said, but I'm not a coach myself, but I think it's a lovely thing to learn.
I see in the background you have the book of Barack Obama as a biography. I just read it a few months ago as well.
Oh, yeah. It's actually, that book is my wife's. I haven't read it.
Yeah. But this makes me connect with this idea that modeling, right? So in Synapse, we help people with a mindset. And sometimes if you don't know many entrepreneurs, if you don't have the mindset of entrepreneurship from a day job, it's difficult to transition. And many people will seek mentors, coaching, join masterminds. Have you done any of that in your career in order to become a better entrepreneur today?
No.
Do you have coach mentors?
No, not exactly what you said. But if, on the other hand, I have joined groups of building vision, projecting a vision in the future. So learning how to work with groups. Maybe I have, I would say 200, 300 hours of participation in these groups. So I could say that in a way I joined, yes, groups, but not mastermind or specific tags or names as these groups that you mentioned. No, but one of the things I helped founding is called Writing the Future. Mm-hmm. Writing the Future was an organization created by my father 22 years ago, and it's based on this principles that I mentioned here, and it really inspires me. And we have three or four groups presently working creating visions or creating a lower form of building a vision, which we do in companies and business, which is building consensus. We think that creating a vision needs more effort, more time, but the first step is by creating the unity between the members, you can create consensus spaces in the company. So that's, in a way, it's a yes for your answer, but not exactly for those examples you gave.
What a beautiful story, what beautiful principles and insights, very rich. Thank you so much for that. Can you give a final message to our audience? We have mostly female, actually, people in our audience that wants to go for entrepreneurship, and we want to bring this equality of the two wings of humanity and in terms of creating and innovating as well. And mostly young people, really. What message do you want to give to them that are making the important decisions?
I'll give a message to women. And the reason why is because I also believe that humanity is like a bird and you have to have two wings with the same strength. Otherwise, this bird will never ascend to the heights that it was promised. Now, the fact is, I'm going to give you an example. I wanted to have a CTO, Chief Technology Officer, that is a woman, a lady. And in 1 week, I got 160 resumes, from which only 8 were women. That tells me a lot. It tells me that even if I insisted with my co-founders that we have to have a woman as a CTO, and I told all my board, my senior advisors, in which I'm always trying to have equality, the number of members that are women and men. But this, in some fields in the society, still there are areas in which women are not very prevalent, like in technology, even in Canada. And why? And this is my message to women. I'm going to even come closer. You know what? Women have this characteristic of being very good to analyze themselves, and they analyze their shortcomings better than men analyze theirs. So I've seen women that refuse to apply to a job because the job description has 16 items, and they do not have 2 of those 16 items. As opposed to men that apply to a job with 16 items, and they know for sure that they don't even have 8 of those. But they say, okay, I'm so good on those 8 that people will overlook my shortcomings and say, you are the right guy. Women do not have that self-confidence. And that's our fault, it's the man's fault. Society has not developed in women self-confidence. And I think women have to be empowered, and they have to be more confident. And men have a role. They have to know that, yes, I'm going to get 160 options. And from them, 154 will be men. But my role now in 2021 is to look into those 6 very, very well and see if one of them can solve our problem. So I help my company to become more equal, regardless of all the statistics, of all the things and principles that we could discuss here. But it's not fair. It's more competitive for men. Men have 160 options. You will get a better person. No, put above those things, of course, you have to have compatibility. You have to have talent. You have to have deliverables. You have to have capacity. You have to, you know, it's not a joke. This is a company, but you have to also understand equality. And in order to take equality as an important thing, you have to be a risk taker as well in that realm, right? And how can you be an entrepreneur without being a risk taker? So this is my message, not only to women, but to men as well.
What a beautiful closing. Thank you so much, Nathan, for your time.
Thank you very much, Alex.
Did this talk inspire you? Are you yourself looking for more fulfillment in your life but feel stuck and overwhelmed at the moment? Do you also want to unleash the best version of yourself? You have come to the right place. Power of Synapse is our revolutionary program that will help you achieve your goals, remove your limiting beliefs, and create the life you have always dreamed of. Get ready to kiss overwhelm goodbye forever. To learn more, join mysynapse.eu/power. That's mysynapse.eu/power. Best part, if you are listening to this podcast and want to start changing now, you can benefit from a 15% discount by entering the code BECOME15 on our website at mysynapse.eu/power. We can wait to see you there. And also, please don't forget to follow us, leave us a review, and let us know what you would like to hear next.